Justify. Prove to be right or reasonable. Justification is at the heart of all legal and political argument. But at a time when argument itself is slave to appearances, it is time to bring back a culture of justification. Justify, a podcast on law and politics in India from the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, hosted by Orgho Sengupta.
Welcome to another episode of Justify. As India prepares to go to the polls, this season is dedicated to examining issues of law and policy which shape our nation. The new declaration at the end of 2023's G20 summit brought to the fore an important fact that India now sees itself as a global player on the world stage. But how do other countries see India? India also, very quickly sometimes, can see itself as a historical victim. So it finds itself in an interesting position. How do we make sense of this global agency combined with historical victimhood? This comes especially at a time when the government of India has embarked on a campaign of decolonization of our cities, of our symbols, and also of our laws. So it will be interesting to think about how India is perceived from the outside, particularly from the mothership, the United Kingdom. And I'm delighted to welcome Kanishka Narayan. Kanishka was with me in Oxford when we were both there at Balliol College. He went to Stanford after that and now is a Labour candidate for MP from the constituency of Vale of Glamorgan, which is in South Wales. Kanishka, welcome to Delhi and welcome to Justify.
Hey, it's delightful to be back. Thanks very much, Orgho.
Thanks, Kanishka. So let's start. Tell me a little bit about yourself. You come from an immigrant family. You went to Oxford, the finest university that exists in the United Kingdom, without any doubt. And now you are running for election. So tell me a little bit about how it all started.
Yeah, it actually all started here in India. So I was born in India. I grew up initially in Bihar and then Delhi, and then moved as a family to the UK, like so many others, chasing opportunity very early in my childhood. Went through, I think, the academic transformation that many did, which is a starting point of pursuit of science and engineering, translating ultimately to a pursuit of economics and politics, as many people in Britain end up doing. And so when I was at Oxford and when we had our shared time at Oxford, I was already very deeply interested in public policy and spent my initial career in the civil service and ultimately in the private sector, thinking about economics in particular. And felt that both generally politics was a deeply impactful source of professional pursuit, but equally at the same time, there's a very particular moment in Britain where I think we're at a crossroads nationally, economically in particular as well, for what Britain looks like in the future. And so it felt like both a good time, but also a continuation of what I've always wanted to do.
Great. So you actually have this interesting perspective on India as an insider, outsider. As you said, you grew up in Patna and, you said Bihar, but I assume it's, I kind of knew it's Patna, I think, from a previous conversation we had. And I remember at that time in Bihar, there used to be this famous saying, Jab tak rahega, samosa mein aalu, tab tak rahega Bihar mein aalu. So you've seen that and now you're running for election yourself. How has your view on India changed, if at all, over the last three decades?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a very personal evolution of it, and that the starting point was a very inward-looking personal experience of growing up as a kid in India. And then subsequently, I think both a professional interest when I was working in the private sector, primarily focused on technology, India's positioning in that, both from a talent point of view and from an infrastructure point of view, as an obvious source of learning. And intellectually, you know, both at Oxford and all the way through since then, I've had a deep interest. The weighting on those has shifted over time, but I think all three of those lenses, the personal, the professional, and the intellectual, combine. I'm here in part visiting friends and family, and there's a deep sense of what people call the living bridge between the United Kingdom and India, and I think, you know, I feel a very clear and obvious sense of it. In terms of sort of the substantive evolution of my experience of India, it's obviously been one that has mapped India's trajectory as well, which is of feeling in the early days, people talking about India as a rising superpower, and now having a very clear sense of thinking about it from the context of UK politics as as a partner, which is clearly a risen powerhouse. So that evolution has also been an exciting one to witness.
Well, that's right. So let's dive a little bit deeper into tech, an area that you are very familiar with, and an area that that India is credited for as trying to do something innovative, particularly in terms of creating digital public goods. So whether it is the Aadhaar ecosystem or UPI, the payments interface, and many others that have been built on top of that. So how do you see, as someone who has worked in tech very deeply for a period of time, how do you see India's public positioning on tech, that tech needs to be built as a digital public good, as opposed to large private corporations essentially running the show? And secondly, in terms of where you see this going, as you said that the trajectory, India's trajectory in the last 30 years, and one of the areas where it has grown immensely is technology. Where, as an outsider looking in, do you see this tech journey going?
Yeah, I think one of the things, the digital public goods aspect of it and really the sense of delivery on it has been pretty remarkable to witness in India. The pace with which you were able to build a payments infrastructure that I think many countries have aspired to build for a long time has been a source of learning for a number of us in the UK and way beyond it as well. So the starting point is, I think India's journey, both in terms of shaping a distinct vision for technology, a digital public goods vision, as you say, has been instrumental and instructive, but a sense of getting things done in that context, I think, has also been deeply instructive. In terms of where things go from here, I think there are some common lessons and there's some distinct trajectories that each of us as countries aspire to. The common lessons are, one, a focus, and we were talking about some of this earlier, which is, how do you orient what feels like a very difficult thing to orient, run by a very small number of private corporations? How do you orient that towards public outcomes and towards a focus on welfare? That's something we're trying to do deeply in the British context as well, and is something that I'm personally very passionate about. I think some of the lessons from India of how you embed a sense of dignity in people's experience of technology when you're thinking about welfare is critical. Even now in the British context, people's ability to be assessed promptly and fairly and then get support from the state in times of need in a prompt and dignified way is a cause that I think we can radically improve on. So there are some very clear lessons on how you orient technology towards public goods, but also public welfare foremost as the outcome that you're interested in. I think each of us as countries has to navigate our own paths on what the public conversation and relationship with aspects of our values, not least on privacy, end up looking like. And I think there's a very particular conversation in Britain on that, and rightly driven by the sense of values that we hold together.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What's happening in Britain on that issue?
Yeah, I think we are still working our way through models of data collaboration and data sharing, and in particular for life-saving research and public goods aspects, which strike the right balance between what we hold deeply dear and I feel very keen on, which is our sort of culture of privacy and individual freedom, with what I know we also share in common, which is a total focus on Britain's future as a productive economy, as an economy where people are able to get the healthcare services in particular and draw on remarkable resources in the NHS to make that happen. So that mediation between what we deeply value on privacy and what we deeply value for our public services is one we're working through. And by the way, I think the one thing I'll say on that is that conversation has evolved in light of technology. In some ways, some of these policy debates end up being downstream of technological possibility.
That's
if
you're right.
Able to develop aspects of privacy preservation into the way you're building technology, I think you're able to cut through what might seem otherwise intractable trade-offs.
That's right, because I think there's a very interesting parallel here that the UK, certainly in my head, was the archetypal welfare state. When I went there as a student, it was a really pleasant surprise that everything in healthcare was free. And I remember I was very sick and everything was free, whether it was just going to the GP or even going to the hospital for some treatment.
And it was free even when we visited, and my son had a fall in Pembroke colleges and everything, and the JR was still mercifully free. And in my head, that's really what a welfare state is about. But of course, in the UK, over the course of the last decade, as there has been the diminishing of this welfare state, whether it's through cuts to the NHS or in other areas where the state was actively propping up people's lives where they couldn't do it themselves. In India, on the other hand, which has promises of a welfare state in its constitution, it has never really felt like one. And it certainly felt less like one when the Prime Minister Modi came to power in 2014. And there were a lot of, at least people in India Inc. and the private sector felt that this would be now the dawn of free market economics in India, and it would mark the end of the welfare state in some sense. But what we've seen in India is a more sophisticated, digitized form of welfare delivery. So if we actually see in terms of welfare delivery, the numbers have gone up and not gone down. The number of schemes, whether it is pension or women's and children's education or disability, as in the number of schemes which are essentially direct benefit transfer schemes, have gone up. And that's primarily through technology. So how do you see this development in the UK, number one, in terms of is the welfare state a thing of the past, or is it something that you as a Labour Party candidate want to revive? And two, how do you see technology playing a role, if at all, in that revival?
Yeah, look, I think it's way easier, of course, to shape the course of these things when it's easier to paint on a blank canvas than it is to do on a canvas which already has a painting on it. That said, I think two things. One, the starting point on welfare is very often a question of size and scope, whereas from my point of view, the starting point is context of underlying values, which is, as a Labour candidate, the Labour Party was founded as the party of working people, driven by a set of values for the state being a source of great support, and not just the state, but community and social organisation being a source of deep support in times of ultimate need. And I'm deeply proud that not just the Labour Party, but the Labour Party specifically in Wales, had a radical history of supporting the creation of the National Health Service. And it's something I'm deeply proud of and committed to. In terms of future trajectory, I think what we have to do, and this speaks to both of your questions, we have to paint a trajectory that is grounded in those values of how do we support people when they most need it in a context that is not just focused and grounded in dignity and compassion, but is grounded in collective progress. Whilst at the same time doing it in a way that is attuned to both our economic and fiscal reality, but also our underlying structural realities, which are primarily in large part driven by demography. So what does that mean in practice? It means, for example, in the healthcare context, a state that is much smarter about prevention rather than turning up at the point of acute need alone. And again, going back to the conversation we were having earlier, one of the things that's remarkable in what Britain's been able to do is become effectively the world's lab when it comes to genomics-focused machine learning. The UK Biobank has been a core data set for it, say, shared in a very safe and narrowly targeted way at life-saving research done by public organisations primarily. So prevention rather than turning up at the point of acute need. Whenever you've committed to a specific size and scope of the welfare, delivering on it with a sense of consistency and dignity for the individual. These are not politically contested ideas. These are just ideas of what a smart strategic state ought to look like in the future. And I think there's a huge amount in that space that is really underpinned by technological possibility.
That's right. And I think that when you were speaking, what struck me was that some of the driving impetus behind the tech revolution in India goes back to what we were saying earlier in terms of India feeling like it is a risen power, that it wants to now do things its own way. And I think this digital public good is seen as an original Indian idea of how to shape 21st century tech. So the casualty in this, and this is the political messaging, is that we are now in an age of decolonization. So the casualty is, in that sense, colonization, which is seen in some sense as synonymous, of course, with Britain. Of course, the French and the Portuguese were also here, but of course, exerted far less influence on our lives. So as a person of Indian origin who's now in the UK and running for parliament in the UK, what's your view on decolonization?
Yeah, I think the starting point for my view is that recognition of empire is an integral aspect of honesty about one's identity, both at the level of the individual and the level of the country. When it comes to decolonization, you know, I'm conscious there's a series of things happening in India, and my view on that is a relatively informed by my standing in Britain, which is that I think it's really important for all of us to reckon with our history as well as our sense of where we want to go to shape the present. And we do it in our particular views as on technology. We do it here in light of the particular values and conversations we share in our respective countries. And I think for India to do that is not just appropriate, but enriching, and I think to be welcomed. In the British context, we've had a series of similar conversations where we're again trying to be very honest about where we've come from, match that with where we want to go to shape where things are at the moment, and that's an appropriate conversation. It has a personal element to it, which is obviously history of India informs my family's history, and I think ancestry rather than sort of accounting as assets and liabilities is the appropriate discipline when it comes to this sort of question, and informs a huge part of you know what I want the world to look like, and the values that are important to me as an individual. And you know, one of the things I find a happy element of it is that those are values deeply shared, not just across Britain, but in particular also in the Labour Party, which played an important role in the historical process of decolonization, not just the contemporary conversation on it.
That's right. And I think this talk about shared values, and I think that became even clearer in the 2030 roadmap signed by Prime Minister Modi and Boris Johnson in 2021, which talked about the shared values and interests. And so could you tell me a couple of ways, and this cuts across political parties in the UK and political establishment in the UK generally, that India is seen as significant for the 21st century? If you could give specific examples of where and how the political establishment of the UK thinks of India is significant.
Yeah, so I think the starting point is probably the context of international relations and geopolitics, where you know, Britain since 2016 has had a canvas to paint its future identity on the international stage. And I was delighted that our Shadow Foreign Secretary was here actually just a few weeks ago, making a very clear commitment to India, not just in terms of a series of interpersonal relationships that so many of us carry, but in geopolitical terms, as a fundamental partner in the future of Britain on the world stage, and a partner where there are some specific elements. You know, we've had this trade conversation that's been long running, promised a few Diwalis ago, and I'm really glad that the David and the team have committed to finishing the job. I was delighted that David was here with the Labour Shadow Foreign Office team a few weeks ago, committing not just to deepening the relationship that we have, which has been built on, as I said, this living bridge that so many of us have walked across, but in specific part, committing on the trade agreement side of it. As I was saying, we had a commitment quite a few Diwalis ago to finishing the job on a trade deal that hasn't yet been concluded. And so I'm really glad that the Labour Party has said we're going to get that job done. That's a very specific element. I think there's some very specific elements across a number of areas, collaboration on green technology being a very obvious one. I think there's a huge sense in which we're continuing to benefit from Indian talent and Indian students. Two of us both shared time in Indian in British
But
academia.
numbers are dwindling, I believe. I was looking at some data that the UK has always been a huge destination for Indian students, but numbers post-COVID have been dwindling.
Yeah, I mean, I think whether that's a structural thing or a cyclical one is unclear to me. You know, from my point of view, I think British academia still has a huge amount to offer, and the prospect of studying in Britain is not just the prospect of a transactional relationship, but of a very deep, long-running history, as well as I think, and I hope, a deep future. So, if you're an Indian student, you know, I hope it's still deeply attractive to bring those numbers up. My sense is, I think actually Indian student numbers have a degree of volatility post-COVID, but I think 2 years ago it was materially on the up again, and specifically for postgraduate education, it continues to be an amazing destination for Indian students, and I'm really glad for it.
Yeah, and I would certainly strongly endorse it as a great destination, not just for the friends you make. But in India, there is a, if I were to play devil's advocate, there is a sense that the UK, while of course a country with which we have deep personal relationships and a deep historical connection, is a country of the past. And there is a kind of sense that the UK's time has come and gone. And while the Prime Minister continues to maintain cordial relations with a succession of British Prime Ministers, there is this kind of sense that this is a relationship that will remain warm and cordial, but it's not significant or as significant as perhaps it should be. What's your take on this position?
Look, I think the main thing I think Britain and India share now is a pursuit and a chase of the future. That's certainly the kind of politics I'm focused on, and it's something I feel whenever I visit India or speak to friends and family in India, and vice versa. I hope we feel this mutual sense that actually I think the best days for both our countries are ahead of us. That's not just a claim of political sloganeering; it's grounded in empirical facts of British standing in a number of areas. If you are an investor in India, empirically, it is the case that you are investing a very material amount in Britain at the moment. India is a huge source of foreign direct investment into Britain. If you are a cutting-edge machine learning scientist, you will be interested to know that the UK, only behind the US, is the largest source of significant machine learning systems. It's not any other country that you might imagine, it's the United Kingdom. If you're interested in biotechnology, British biotech companies, GSK in particular, had a huge role to play in the development of vaccines. And so, if you are a cutting-edge life sciences researcher growing up in India and want to think about spending time somewhere else, the UK is a remarkable frontier country chasing the future in that regard as well. If you're interested in the future of literature and indeed law, the UK and India have a huge shared past, and as a consequence, I think a foundation for a shared future. And so, we can. I don't think international relations are best built on hierarchies of where countries sit on these regards. But even if we were to chase that sort of line of inquiry, I think Britain would have a pretty good claim to partner with India as two countries focused very squarely on chasing
I think that's a sales pitch that's hard to top. And I think it's a sales pitch
the
that's not necessary because I do feel that these are momentary reactions that you feel that we're going to fight the past. But as you said, we need to build towards a common future. So let me end with a personal question because a lot of our listeners are young law students, graduate students in various disciplines. And a lot of them want a career in public life. And you have had a remarkable journey growing up in Bihar and in Delhi, and now running for public office in England at a very young age. And so, what would be the takeaway from your life in terms of what would you say to someone who wants to be in public office but doesn't really know how, and is a 20-year-old in some college in India? Interested in public office, doesn't really know how to do it. What would your advice to such a person be?
Yeah, I feel I've often asked people for advice on career questions, and one of the things I've felt back is the sense that the path people take is not just very particular to their circumstances, but often very coincidental in the present and rationalized in the past. So that's a big caveat. But here's a couple of things that I've always reflected on. One, chasing the biggest questions of interest to you has been my kind of consistent thread over the course of my career. So I started as a civil servant as an economist, and then worked in finance, thinking about tech financing. I was in the US for a bit, brief bit, and was an investor. Worked for the Labour Party, and now I'm running for office. So across bureaucracy, financial services, investing in technology, the United States, and then back in Britain, the single thread has been what is the both mechanism, but also the location from which I can think about macro questions that are interested me. In the most impactful way. The second element of it has been very people-driven. Public life and politics in particular is a pure people business, and you're trying to effectively build a common shared sense of both values and a sense of where you want to go individually as a political party and as a country. And so the biggest determinant of the things I've tried to do have been where I felt I can be with people who drive me, who build a better sense of who I can be and a sense of who we can be together as well. So those are the kind of two very obvious lessons. The very third specific thing I'll say for public life is this, which is whilst public questions have been of interest to me for a very long time, active politics has not been the thing that I thought I'd do at each part of my career so far. And actually, it's only in a recent period, probably about 3-4 years ago, when I started very actively thinking about it for two reasons. One, I think it felt to me that Britain in particular was at a stage where the next general election and the one after that are going to be critical drivers of our long-term future. And that felt like a very impactful moment. But two, I think I built a deep sense of conviction with a degree of distance when I was in the United States, looking back in my experience in the UK and feeling a sense of agency that I think is influenced in part by, I think, what America does very well, which is build a sense that if you want to do something, you should just go and chase that thing directly. I'm not sure if that combines into a rational bundle, but those are the things I'd say, which is the most important questions, the people who will drive you the most, and third, to strike with a sense of agency in it.
Well, that's great. And I think that's very clear advice. That, you know, follow your heart, answer the questions that you want to. And at the end of the day, don't hold back. And if you can do things directly, do them directly. Because I know there is a lot of hesitation about active politics in India as well, certainly amongst people who belong to the middle class generally. I remember my father telling me that politics is not for us. And I think that view is changing. And I think folks like yourself are at the vanguard of that change. So best of luck for the upcoming elections. I hope you win. And I hope that we get you on a future episode of Justify as a member of parliament, if not something more.
Well, I'd be delighted to. But the final thing I'll also say on this is one of the best ways to do politics and public life generally is to do it in the company of others who are pursuing similar goals. So I'm delighted, Olga, that what you built at Vithi has been remarkable and very much in the ecosystem of things that carry us all forward.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining me. Thank you.
As we close, it's time for Free and Fair, our special audience poll, where as the listener, you get to exercise your franchise. Today's question: should India aim for global leadership first, or should we solve our domestic issues of jobs and growth? To vote, go international, or focus on domestic issues, visit my Twitter account @orgo_justify. You have 48 hours. Adjourned.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, follow us on Twitter @Vidhi_India for regular updates. We are on SoundCloud and Spotify as Vidhi Center for Legal Policies Podcast. You can also listen to us on Google Podcasts or iTunes. Email us at justify@vidhilegalpolicy.in to share your comments and feedback on this episode.